Today is Monday, July 29th, 2002. Today's session is titled Food Forum, a visit to the local organic farms that supply some of Holden's food. The number is FO2002-31. Let's listen in.
I guess maybe we should introduce ourselves first. I'm Chrissy. I'm here in my last month of food service coordination. I've been here 2 years.
I'm Miriam, and I'm here in my first summer of food service coordination.
I'm Jeremy, and I'm near my second year of plumbing.
And I'm Lisa, and I'm in my second year of media ministry.
We had some interesting assortment of people.
Yeah. We didn't really talk about exactly how we were going to do this, but all four of us went out. To visit three of the farms that we get quite a bit of the produce and some meat from the village. And so our thought was tonight that we would just tell a little bit about that visit and have you ask questions and go from there. And I've been talking now for a while.
I guess I can just outline a little bit of what that visit was about. When we came out of Holden, we went first to Sunny Pine, which is a farm that's in Twist in the Tao Valley, which is about an hour and 15 minute drive from where Chelan is. And we stayed on, hung out with the farm manager there, who is Tori Karpinko, who used to be on long-term community here at Holden and was in Lawns and Gardens and is now, and has been for a year and a half, the farm manager at Sunny Pines. And kind of took us on a tour through his fields, and we spent a bit of time with him, and the next day spent a little bit of time on the farm doing various things like picking raspberries. And Jeremy and I made lunch for the group of interns that are there helping out and doing all of the work on the farm right now. And talk to them and talk to Ed Welch, who owns the land and doesn't live on the land but lives near it in Twist. And so we talked to all of them over lunch for a while about a lot of things, actually. Mm-hmm. And from there, we went over, I'm forgetting, we'll go back there. From there, we went over to Leavenworth, where Grant Gibbs has a small, small family farm, right outside of the town of Leavenworth. And he has a pretty amazing farm, which he has worked to essentially dependent on almost no resources that come from outside of his farm. He works so that basically his farm sustains itself, and the animals that he has, he uses the manure from the animals to compost his fields, to grow various stuff. He has a cycle of growing that is very, in some ways, very meticulous and planned out so that each crop helps the crop that comes after it. He's definitely put a lot of thought into it. His land is really beautiful, and he also provides us with some amount of produce and some animals too that come off his farm. And actually, the first afternoon that we were out, the three of us, Jeremy and Chrissy and I, went to Jeff Berman. Jeff Berman's place that is 25 Mile Creek, so about an hour and a half, a mile and a half from where the B&B is, if somebody might have stayed there. And he just has basically a homestead and has a hugely glorified garden and orchard. And his business isn't to kind of make a business of his farming at all, but he has a fair amount of fruit and sometimes some other things like hot peppers and various other random things that he sends up to us, sends up to Holden. He has a kind of a long relationship with Holden and with this area. And so we were able to see those three different, in some ways, or in others, farms, basically of a very small size, but even within that, three different sizes and three different kind of points to those farms. And I think what's further kind of wonderful about it is all of those farmers know each other and have spent time together up here and know each other from the area. And we
didn't know this when we found them. So yeah. It's kind of fun to sit in various living rooms and have conversations
with a few of them
talking about each other.
So that's a little bit of an outline of what we did in this couple of days that we were out.
I only want to add, you laughed at the fact that there's a plumber and a media person, and I guess food touches everyone in this community, and especially the long-term staff. I think it seemed really important that somebody who's not just dealing with food take an interest in the food, and I went along for no other reason than I was asked, and then I eventually started doing videotape, but I know if I lived in this community long-term that I would make it a point to be a part of the food, because it does touch everybody aside from our roles in the community. So I like that. I definitely got to appreciate what we put on our table.
I guess I would say this trip, I've visited Sunny Pines before, and I've been interested in food ever since before I got up here, but since I've been up here and been dealing with more food sourcing issues, I've really come to see that as kind of a bedrock for living a life of integrity. In the world that we live in right now, I feel like there's so many choices that I can't make and don't make that are made for me in many ways, in production and consumption and the developed nation lifestyle that we live in. And so when I start thinking about, well, protesting a war or, you know, protesting how we consume or doing other things like that, I feel like if I don't root myself somehow in some kind of truth, that it would be very, I'll feel very false about any other kind of action that I would take. And so food right now is really representing something to me that's very basic and essential to my life. And this trip has really cemented in my mind that at some point in my life, I have to be willing to, I'm not a farmer and I'm never going to be a farmer. I might be a small time production of growing my own food somewhere. And I think that's been a pretty important realization that I have to do that. I have to be able to work and produce some of my own food, be somewhat self-sufficient in that way, so that I can keep some of those choices under my own wing and feel good about them and go forward from there. And other choices that I make or try to get other people to make as well. So, and just living with the three farmers, the three farms in general, it's just, it's an amazingly wonderful thing. Of course, we're only there for a day, and so we get all the beautiful romantic aspects of it, and what we can see and understand that there's a lot of work that goes into it. But it really was just a lovely experience. For me, most best summed up by Grant Hughes' place, which is just an incredible, diverse little plot of land that contains everything that you would ever need to live. And it's amazing that the man has been able to work so steadily and so with so much integrity on one aspect of life and living, and also try to spread it to other people. It's really very important, the education process throughout this whole valley with ways of growing food, the ways of distributing food, and the connection that it should have in our lives.
I had a lot of fun visiting these farms for, it's been probably the third or fourth visit to some of them for me. And I had a wonderful time, I guess, showing people what I had already seen. And I was, I think, again, surprised by one of the gifts in being able to be here as we've started to get more produce from local organic farms is that I didn't know any of these people to begin with. And at this point, as I'm leaving, I think of them all as friends. And I've, Christian and I were going through Christianus, who's trained to be taking my spot. We're looking at different files and, you know, realizing that there were stacks of handwritten letters from Grant and I, or Ed and I, or any of these farmers, and that wasn't something that I really thought about when I started the whole process of ordering from them. And now to see this community and their communities kind of come together and have a relationship that's both based on food but also beyond that at this point, but I don't think that will go away in a few years for myself, but also for this community. And I think that's a very different picture than, say, going and visiting a Cisco representative, who's a wonderful man, but, you know, it's not, yeah, there's no magical farm there. There's no way to go and pick in his fields or enjoy the people who are there. So it's been, I don't know, just one of those times where I realized that what you start out with doing has become quite an amazing thing. I'm glad that the community is going that direction.
How do you make sure that the greens, say, get to the table fresh? How often do you have them brought up?
Like lettuce comes once a week from Sunny Pond.
Does it keep okay for a week?
Yeah, we prepare it the day ahead for a salad, but otherwise it's not chopped ahead of time.
Uh-huh. And you have big refrigerators to keep it in?
What percentage, or I don't have any feel for what percentage we're talking about here, when you, if you look at the total amount of food consumed at Holden over a year, what percentage are you talking about?
It's changed pretty considerably at this point. It's close to half of our food that comes from local or organic sources. Produce, certainly over the winter, we get as much as we can. We get potatoes and squash and garlic, but that's going to come from somewhere else. But in the height of the summer, moving in the next couple weeks, we'll start getting almost everything from farms. So it's a pretty good chunk of food. And within that, Sunny Pond can provide us almost all of our produce needs. Jeff Berman, in a week, might send up a couple hundred pounds of peaches or apricots or apples or something, and that'll be two or three meals of fresh fruit on our table. So it's either little bits or quite a lot.
Well, one of the interesting things too, Jeff is a good example of, in some ways, we're, in many ways, we're providing Jeff with just as much as he's providing us. Instead of having, he lives in a fairly remote place, and so getting his stuff to market is not the easiest task in that world. It takes a lot of time and effort. It's not even necessarily something that he particularly enjoys all that much. Grant, on the other hand, loves to go to market and talk about it as much as he can. And it's a great thing he does. Jeff doesn't seem to really enjoy that side of it as much. So, in essence, what we're providing for Jeff and his family is this place to dump whatever food they have. We can pretty much take whatever they give us and allow him to continue his lifestyle
and the family's left so without having to worry about marketing. So.
And it's coming from 5 minutes from the boat dock, which is pretty different than the produce you buy in a grocery store that's, or say our bananas that come from God knows where. And certainly travel thousands and thousands of miles. So we're not perfect.
And there's still a lot of things. I mean, one thing that Beth and I, Beth Stewart and I talked about before is the ice cream. I mean, we try to do all these good things with food, and we try to talk about eating minimally and all sorts of stuff. And then you see this line of 150 people, and I'm guilty as well. I go out all the time to get ice cream, and we get these massive quantities of ice cream that comes from here. So there's definitely catches that line, but you know, take away ice cream from this place, we might have a riot. How to do that?
Not if it's a family place.
Kids are needy.
So. Start cranking your own.
Yeah. And the scoop size might have to go on as opposed
to. How about cost issues?
Another good question. What we have found is that up to this point, our budget has increased 10% in the 2 years that I've been here, which is a relatively normal change. Some of it initially was to allow for us to try different food sources. The surprising thing about a change from, say, it was more like 25% local organic to half local and organic is that our budget didn't really change. What happens is that because we buy directly from the farmers and because we know the farms, we don't have any sort of middle people that we're paying. That allows the farmers to keep their prices down and to really get a pretty good price for what they're giving us. Delivery, we're close enough that it's not a huge issue for them. So that's helpful too. Past this point, we would need to do some serious, I think, changing of our budget or re-envisioning how we might spend our money on food. I think you can do a lot in a household just by being creative and using what's available. We have, and sometimes it's really frustrating, but we are trying to use what's available, and it can mean menu changes, and it can mean, well, the meat didn't come from somewhere, and I have a headache the next day trying to put together something. But we do try and use what we have. We'll buy whole animals, we'll buy bulk ahead of time, we'll get barge loads of stuff.
So do they butcher, for example, for you?
Yes.
It's all you have to do. Is...
We don't butcher here yet.
Yeah. Okay.
And not the next 3 years.
Well, Dan's here. He'll
butcher. Well, there's actually been an idea floating around. Well, okay, I floated around. Yeah, we should have a hunting party. But it would be fairly easy for us to get enough meat in the local area here to provide meat for the winter.
Deer.
That also runs into some problems.
Have you changed the menu at all to reflect the seasonal nature of a lot of the produce that you get?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, initially, the whole, I guess, move towards getting more local and organic food was not a move to change our menu. It wasn't to become completely vegetarian or to do anything particularly different. As it's gone on, yeah, we've changed our menu pretty substantially in some ways, and in other ways we've left things the same.
Can you give examples?
We still have hamburger from time to time, but it's organic hand-formed patties, and it's less often because it's more work. Things like beef stroganoff, we were able to use this last Sunday mostly organic. We actually didn't have quite enough, but at various times we've instead of serving a big steak on your table or a slice of meat, we've, you know, chosen to have stroganoff because then we don't need quite as much and we can afford organic meat instead of buying through Sysco. So some things like that change. We don't have corn on the cob on the menu right now because it's not available and ready, but when it is, we'll have it every week, twice a week. So some of those things, I think, are starting to really affect our diet. Winter squash.
I said that to me, Mitch, I think was one of the good things, neat things that happened. And it serves, you know, up to 1,200 meals a day. They're willing to go with the punches, play with the punches, you know. The corn's ready now, we'll have corn, or the tomatoes need to come in. We've got to do something. That's one of the things. So the menu, in my mind, has changed to reflect what we can get, what's available, which is what I did at home when I was growing up on a farm. It's more reflective of the small, what you can do at home. They're doing more of that sort of thing in the kitchen here than being an institutional kitchen.
Yeah.
That's why I kind of jumped in there to say, yes, in the positive sense. Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about the concept of organic, like if you know it on a basic level, but what that involves in different types of food and that process? Maybe.
Why
not?
What's
the
organic meat?
What does organic mean? You guys, check me, probably most of you know at least as much as I do about this, but organic is when you're talking about vegetable product or any sort of like vegetable or grain or fruit. Talking about vegetable, grain, or fruit that has been grown on land that the plants have not had any sort of pesticide or herbicide used on them, that chemicals have been, it's been a chemical-free process. And there are kind of actually rather huge, and perhaps there's actually a lot of political debate over the stipulations that right now exist in the government about what you have to do essentially on a farm to be a registered organic, you know, be an organic farm and have that certified organic stamp of approval from the U.S. government. The stipulations are actually pretty strict and expensive and strict enough that a lot of really small farmers can't afford and can't meet those regulations, even though they may be doing 95% of what that process is, or you know, as much as they can. But I think the hope for most of those farmers on a kind of a small level and on a bigger level is that they're not using chemicals or in their growing process. When you're talking about meat, then you're talking about animals that are raised with no hormones kind of shot into them, raised on feed that is also organically produced and raised, so that the usual, well, a lot of the animals in this country that are raised for our food are shot full of a lot of hormones. There's a lot that's kind of put into them, and they're raised on feed that is far from organically produced, genetically engineered, you know, the kind of what you see actually when you drive through a lot of the Midwest. A lot of the soybeans and cornfields are feed for the cattle that will eventually become our meat, and it's kind of an interesting process to think of those levels of remove and think of what kind of what provides the food and what that food is and how we're distributing our land, and then I mean, there's a lot of issues there, but so that's kind of a basic idea of organic. I think one thing that we're thinking a lot about at Holden. You can go to a lot of cities and towns now and go to the, you know, the co-op or the yuppie health food store or, you know, whatever that place is, and you can get organically grown, you know, pomegranates from, you know, 3,000 miles away. That's an interesting idea now. What have we done there? You know, well, okay, so it's organic, but what happened to that food to get it here? And now that I'm in my little yuppie health food store, I'm paying, you know, $5 for this organically grown pomegranate. I think that I use that example only to say that there's definitely an organic movement in this country that is, I think a lot of people associate that with a very upper class phenomena or a very upper middle class phenomena of, okay, this food, it may be organic, it doesn't use any chemicals in the process, but people aren't thinking a lot about where that food is from. They're still shipping it, you know, across countries and across continents. It's very often, it is way more expensive than, you know, going to the local Safeway or going to the local Costco and getting, you know, the food that you need to feed your four kids, you know. I think that one thing that Holden is thinking about and a lot of people are thinking about right now is not only organic or perhaps more than organic, but local. Is the food that I'm getting, do I know where it's coming from? And how is that food gotten from, you know, the field to my table? And wouldn't it be great if that food didn't use up, you know, gallons and gallons of gas and fossil fuels to get from that land to here and go through not one middleman, but possibly, you know, three or four along the way. If you think of processed foods that, you know, it starts out as a soybean that gets shipped to Florida and, you know, gets processed into oil, that gets shipped to California, that gets made into some sort of TV dinner that's shipped to New York where I'm finally eating it. That food has gone like across the country about five times. And here I'm finally eating it. When you think of the cost of that food, you know, maybe for me, the cost has been seemingly minimal when I look at the price tag. But as I've come to think more about this, what's really the cost on the environment? What's the cost of all the fossil fuels that have been used to transport that food? So this is a lot of Amish now, but
is that one of the reasons then that organic food can be more expensive is because of how far it's come, how far it's traveled?
No, and not at all. I think that a lot of organic food is expensive because there's
it's more time consuming.
It's more time consuming.
It's a lot more labor intensive.
You know, and now that a lot of, I mean, it's this kind of crazy change that happened in just this past century. Like just this past century. And I mean, I find it really amazing that, you know, who was, I think one of the farmers was saying this when we were there, but, or I was reading this in something, just a couple of generations back, everyone would have known when things were in season, you know, and I grew up not even having to learn that, you know, and not, you know, having to learn because anything I could buy, and it wouldn't really matter when it was, I could go in January and I could buy a tomato. Now that's ridiculous that I buy a tomato in January, but I grew up, me, and I'm 25, you know, born in the 70s, like, that's something that I just came, okay, that's just part of life.
So
in America,
in the United States, very much so, very much so.
I think also one of the interesting things that goes along with organic foods is that the organic idea is starting to be co-opted more and more by a big agribusiness. So, which is kind of nice in some ways. It's great that they're starting to not use many pesticides, but you're still having all the problems that are inherent in huge farms that are still going on. Is it better to buy your produce, your meats, whatever, from someone who is running a farm that's compact and fairly environmentally friendly, maybe uses a little bit of pesticide here and there, or uses a little bit of something that's not quite 100% organic, or organic food that's grown in like mass quantities and shipped however you don't know where you can never actually, like companies like Sysco can't even trace back. If you say, like, where did I get this cabbage from? The Sysco will look at you and say, well, we have so many farms that give us cabbage, there's no way for us to know where exactly it came from, and all those dangers that are inherent in that as well. So the local issue, I think, is just as important. In some ways, it might be a little more important. Organic, I think, will come more when the idea of going back to small farming and sustainable farming comes back into the process. I appreciate it.
Not that it's only about relationships too, but it is about community building, and if you're choosing to build relationships with your local community, you can't do that and support really large corporations, whether they're organic or not. And we couldn't have had this trip if we had chosen to go through an organic distributor based in Seattle. And I think a lot of what we get out of the local food is a relationship and a reminder that we are part of a community that's not just in this valley, it's down lake. What we support affects the people who work in Chelan. Who gets a fair wage? It is a question in this area. I mean, what about farm workers? What kind of housing do they have? We can know that if we go through local sources and we can visit, and we can't if we go beyond a certain area.
I appreciate what you're saying. I personally live in a town in Northwest Washington, about 70,000 people, but it's a formerly rural county, now becoming pretty urbanized, and I'm privileged that I'm able to support community-supported agriculture and buy local produce, but I'm also a little bit different from the person who lives in L.A. or San Francisco or whatever. And what I'm wondering is, I can do my little bit, but there's that farmer in Nebraska who has no choice but to raise soybeans, and probably not much more. I mean, he has to specialize in order to survive.
Exactly.
And he has to rent more and more land in order to survive. And that kind of thing is the complicating factor in my mind. Because I don't have anything against him, and I know he's doing his best to survive and feed his family and all that. But in order to do that, he's got to become bigger and bigger and probably use more of the Earth's resources just to keep producing that food. And that's what I see.
Yeah. When we see that in some ways in the apple industry in this area, that there are so many orchardists who are going out of business, or who are being forced to take out their trees and start over, or have to acquire more and more land to be able to get any sort of living expenses met. And it's tough, because it is a small community and we can know these people. I think hopefully what we're doing is not saying to those people that they're making choices that are wrong. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, what we do is somewhat of a political statement that we are supporting people who are small time for the most part. We are supporting people who are able to keep diverse crops on their land. All of these places that we went and visited have many, many crops. And that is important, both for the land and for this economy. So you can't always do that. You can't be perfect. And I think you hope that
what you're doing is not harming anyone. I think it does bring up an interesting question when you mention that, though, is beyond buying food at a political level or at a, you know, beyond that, what can we do to make farming in this country something that is something people can make a living off of and a good living? Food should be expensive. We all need it. It's certainly not.
I think it's interesting how that picture of that farmer in Nebraska, agribusiness is out there. They don't want him to change. As long as he's out of balance, he needs their product. And coming from North Dakota, in sugar beet and wheat country, I mean, the next thing is GMOs. You know, it's so, you know, they've got the answer. You've got the problems. And I mean, it just appears that, to me, that the best thing you can do is support a small farmer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, because you sure can go up against agribusiness.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe that's the only way that you can.
Yeah, some of those buying choices. I mean, the demand for easy consumed packaged grains and things that are made in that way is lessened, and perhaps people can break big farms back. Government subsidies change a certain way. It doesn't support major agribusiness. Like, there's a lot of different things that could help maybe change that farmer's life around. But the biggest one would be to know that person and try to buy something from them at some point.
And be okay with what they don't have.
Yeah, exactly. That's the biggest thing. I mean, I think more than anything else, the step that I think we touched on briefly is that that's the step that to me is the most important, is to change our own expectations of availability and to realize that food is not, like, we live in a northern climate almost everywhere, and in a certain sphere of this country, most of us are probably from a pretty northern climate where things don't grow after a certain season. Why are we eating them? Or should we be? Should we be not eating? And what should we change our habits? Like, we should we not just eat like potatoes and winter squash and meat for the winter, like things that we can get
and stockpile
of canned goods. This is another idea we had, was to can a lot of goods in the summer
and
bring them through the winter.
But, I think of earlier this summer when we ran out of peanut butter. And we have a commitment to the local co-op in Chelan to support them. They supply us with peanut butter. The peanut butter factory was closed for cleaning. We didn't have peanut butter. And that really raised havoc here in this community. This community wasn't ready to make that commitment.
And so we went to Cisco and got peanut butter from them. And after a few days of, you know, frustration with that.
But that's just a crazy thing. So with all of the food that we have up here, what is given and provided for anyone who comes up here to eat, to not have one thing and to have it cause anxiety and distress and anger and all these other things, we have to step back from that and say, well, something's seriously wrong with us if that's what's going to come out, if we're missing peanut butter for a day. My goodness.
The food is such an intimate issue.
It is. And it's a huge thing of, and I try to give people a huge, especially everyone who comes up here, you're giving up a lot of personal control to come up here. You are, whether you're here for a few days or whether you're here for a few years, you're still relinquishing a lot of personal control. You don't have the control of your own life that most middle-class Americans have learned to take for granted. And I feel personally that a lot of the frustration with that lack of control, and a lot of it has to do with food, that like I don't get to decide what I get to eat. And I speak from a very personal stance that I'm very concerned with what I eat, and I'm very concerned with having a choice in that. And I think that part of my comfort in this village is the fact that I have more of a, I have more control than some in this village because I'm part of the whole kitchen, I'm part of the menuing process, and I'm part of the cooking process of that. And there's a lot of people in this village that have absolutely no part in that process. And so when you don't have any control over that, I think it's very easy that anxieties about food, anxieties about control, anxieties about a lot of other things that really have nothing to do with food come out around food. And kind of like Jeremy's saying, like, how do we look at that? How do we look at kind of our own kind of middle-class American control issues over kind of wanting to be able to have this and this and this and choose that? And how do we relinquish some of that? It's a huge thing. It's a really, really frightening thing.
And do it is such a, I mean, I think for us, we've had questions over time in the kitchen of how do we do the best we can, but also not people make people so angry as to not be open to new ideas. And that's a, that has been an issue over time in the kitchen.
And being a family retreat center with lots of little children, I can see why not having peanut butter. Because these parents are saying, you're going to always have peanut butter and jelly. If you don't like this, there's always peanut butter and jelly.
And the little kids go, I've never seen peanut butter. It looks like that before.
Yeah, right.
I'll never forget my grandmother. This is a kind of a corollary, but my sister, when we were little, she, for some reason, she just fixated on macaroni and cheese, and she would always get, it would be like, there would be many times where we'd make a meal, and then my mother would make macaroni and cheese instead, because she was so insistent, like, I'm not going to eat anything except macaroni and cheese. And we were at my grandmother's house one evening for Christmas or something like that, but not a Christmas meal, but my grandmother had made something and put it on the table, and my sister was like, oh, I don't like that, I eat macaroni and cheese. And my grandmother just matter-of-factly, without even like opening it up for argument, was like, well, then I guess you're not going to eat. Like, and I'm not going to make you macaroni and cheese. And it was like a big conflict, and it still kind of has ramifications in other ways, the relationship between my grandmother and my grandmother. But at the same time, I was like, thank you, Grandma, for saying this, so I don't have to see her eating macaroni and cheese all the time. And, but that, I mean, that is an interesting question. Like, when do we tell people, like, well, hey, there's plenty of food. You'll eat, you'll find something to eat. Don't expect to have this and this and this. Don't expect to have an easy option. It's something you rely on and you're used to all the time. Eat what's available.
Could I go back to an earlier comment that you made, which is a long, very different line, but I think it needs a little different twist. You made the comment about how many orchards are being ripped, apple orchards are being ripped out in Washington State. But we need to talk about what they're doing with that land.
Well, exactly, and I think what we do can affect what they do with that land by where we put the market needs.
Well, I wanted to comment on how, is everybody aware that Washington State is now number two producer of wine in the United States? A lot of those orchards are being ripped out to put in grapes for winemaking.
And it takes years before they're useful, doesn't it?
Oh, it'll take a while, yeah. But they know there's a market. We're now number two. Admittedly, California is way higher in its production, but the point is, going from apples to production of wine, that it's not grape juice, it's wine. I think there's a message in all of that, too, what our society is looking for increasingly.
Yeah. Can you be a little bit more explicit? I'm just trying to... I'm just trying to understand exactly what you're saying there.
I'm saying when you rip out an apple orchard, you do it in order to sell land to people who are going to put in grapes, who are going to make wine. And this is the product that can now be sold. If you can't sell apples, which is true, the bottom has dropped out. You can always sell wine.
Do they make cider by ripping the apples? I mean, is that... I'm from Texas, so I've got,
I'm sure they do make some cider.
The apples are any of the apple orchards around here for alcoholic
consumption? Probably some are made into hard cider, aren't they? I don't know. Yes. But not that's not the big thing. It's apple juice and apples.
Right. And a lot of the apples are being sold overseas.
Yeah. A lot of that's due to the marketing, but for apples too, because of big agriculture and business, that apple production is fairly easy to do in a lot of different places and has been overdone. I mean, Washington shouldn't produce as many apples as they do.
And look at how much is irrigated.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't understand why. Are people eating fewer apples?
No, I have nothing to do with that. Where else are getting them from?
There was this boom. There was this
in
Washington, but then in other countries as well, like in
Japan, I think is taking up a lot of that.
So basically, there was this boom of all of a sudden, all of these apple orchards started producing apples, and all of a sudden you have. I mean, it's kind of. Not to look at it really simplistically and just the capitalist term of like there's a certain amount of a market and all of a sudden you had too many apples.
Could it be a variety thing that people, you know, are tired of delicious and that
they moved from, I mean, there was a kind of red delicious boom and then everybody got really excited about galas and you know, all of the other kinds of types of apples, so they specialized in all these different types, and then everybody else started specializing in all these different types, and then you had, you know, basically there's too many apples. Like, there was not all of a sudden, you know, in 5 or 10 years, you know, like, thousands of more apples. People didn't want thousands of more apples. People wanted just about the same number of apples that they wanted 5 years ago. So
there are growers around the world. As simple as looking at it, it was like 3 or 4 years ago, there was an absolutely wonderful production year. There were so many apples that they had to leave them on the trees. Mm-hmm. It was just beautiful. Yeah. An amount of apples, and then you went down a few weeks later and they were rotting on the trees. And it's that simple. There's too many apples locally, and then now that other countries have picked up on the apple business.
I think it's true that, you know, years ago, and this was the catchphrase in the Midwest, was that we're feeding the world.
Yeah.
Well, if that ever was true, it's not true today, mm-hmm. because the world is feeding itself much more than it ever was. And I think that's, in all agricultural commodities, that's that's the problem. That's why the farmer in Nebraska is out of trouble, you know. It's got to be ethanol or something. We've got to figure out something to do with this stuff.
That's not even necessarily true. The world is feeding itself. The world is feeding the people with the most money, the things that they want.
That's
what they want. It's
right.
countries as well. Most of the South American countries, they can't afford to drink coffee except the freeze-dried coffee is sent back to them from the United States.
I think that the farmer that's producing wheat in North Dakota is competing with a farmer in Argentina that's producing the same wheat, and the same companies are handling it, playing one against the other. And I'm sure it's the same with apples. Mm-hmm.
Good friends are dairy farmers. They're the only dairy farmers left in that county in Texas, and it used to be one of the biggest dairy counties. Mm-hmm. And all the dairies are shutting down because it makes more sense to sell their land for subdivisions than it does to raise cattle on it. And they're all going to the big agribusiness, huge, enormous, and we drove by at least a couple on our way up here, just enormous dairy farms. Mm-hmm. But the government spent so many years paying them to pour the milk out. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was the way to, you know, you got to keep the milk prices down, you got to, you know, pour it out. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't understand. I remember I was a kid the first time I heard them talking about that, and I remember thinking, gosh, isn't there somebody who could be drinking that milk? You know, I mean, you could be making it in a sour cream cheese, something, I don't know, chocolate milk for my school, whatever. But, you know, and it's amazing to me, I mean, you're talking about, I mean, that's an economic thing in America, that when you buy milk, you are very rarely buying milk from an individual dairyman anymore. I mean, I think Bobby can name all the dairymen in Texas. And I mean, that's Texas, you know? It's a frickin' state. And he can name all the families that still have their own dairies in the state of Texas. And he can tell you where they live.
In Washington State, a lot of the dairy farmers have moved to New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Now stop and think about what kind of a climate New Mexico has.
It's a little dry.
And that's where they're raising cattle for dairy production, and that milk is being sent to Florida. Florida is buying New Mexico milk. And
well,
stop and you just stop and think of the implications of this. And I have some friends who have a farm. They're trying to survive on a farm in my county, and they have to milk their cows three times a day. Mm-hmm. Their cows, from the time they are born, well, it's changing, but it very soon it will be that from the time they are born to the time they are slaughtered, they will never be outside. Okay. They will never be in the light. They will always be in some confined unit where they will be ready to produce. In order to do that, of course, you were talking about hormones and all the other things that have to be involved with it. And yet, their point of view is they're frustrated as all get out because they want to make a living. They're having a struggle to make a living. They've got two sons, and they're saying to them, don't consider becoming dairymen. Now stop and think of the implications of that for our country.
This last winter, by spring, I guess, went to getting organic milk. And of course, as I looked into that, for any number of these reasons that you mentioned, as I looked into getting that, you can't go directly to dairy. There are no organic dairy, so you can buy directly from.
No, they give their. They have to give their milk to someone else. There's government reasons for that. It has to go through.
Which is a shame because on the one hand, we could probably support farm pretty easily up here by the amount of milk we go through. And then we ran into this summer that there just isn't enough organic milk production to keep the prices down so that we can afford it. So we're back at regular dairy old milk. And Miriam and I were both at a conference this fall where one of my first conversations was with some Hispanic dairymen or Hispanic farm workers who were very concerned about what the dairies were doing to the water and their children, and they had some fine reasons that they were scared.
And we're still doesn't do that.
We're still drinking a lot of milk. And then there's of course the issues of health too.
That's
an interesting health things attached to it.
Big, farm, just the stock yards that was just recalled all that meat from Greeley, Colorado. I saw a picture in the New York Times of it the other day. It's just this sprawling mass of pinched in things. And it's just like, well, of course there's disease in the meat. Look at how you're growing it. I mean, I think it's as much as sometimes I deplore being part of our rich culture, it's like, we're the people that can change things by choices we as individuals make. I mean, the people that don't have money to make these choices in larger cities and other places are going to have to struggle to get through that. They don't have the luxury of saying, I'm going to take my time and pick this or that. They have to go with what their options are given to them. And gradually that perhaps will improve. But it's only going to improve if a bunch of people say, no, I'm not going to eat this anymore. I can't. I can't do it for my own health. I can't do it for the health of the world. I can't do it for the health of the farmer. And all other various reasons. And it's time for us to stop eating in crazy, messed up ways.
All these things are so connected, and I'm reminded about how this farm I was just telling you about, the dairy farm, the couple that own the land and run the farm, are just phenomenal in the amount of hours they work, and you've all heard that before, and all of their employees, and they have to have employees when they have that many cows, 350 cows I think it is, and all of their employees are Hispanic migrant workers, and most of them are illegal. There's no way they can survive with legal workers. Does that say anything?
Yeah, that's true. Just look at the various businesses around the country and which of those businesses and where are those businesses and who, where you're like, well, of course these people are illegal. You just know, from very much, from early up in I grew up in New York City and
worked at, you know, my first work experience was in a cafe where, of course, everybody was illegal and nobody asked me how old I was, and I wasn't legal to work, you know, but nobody else was a citizen, so they couldn't have worked. So, but like starting with that work experience to my last work experience before I came here, where I was working in New Mexico and in the restaurant business, and it's just very clear, it's a very clear class system in New Mexico and in other countries, that in other states, and I don't even know how widespread this is, but that, you know, the chefs, you know, are maybe foreign or American, and the wait staff is Anglo white, and the kitchen work, the kitchen help is immigrant Mexican. And it was just like, you looked at every restaurant and you were like, oh yeah, that's the class system here, you know? So it's fascinating to me.
One of the things, just thinking of things Golden has done, beyond just connecting with local farms, PQN is a farm workers union in Oregon. And Holden, in the last 10 years, I want to say, has been fairly involved with that, and done quite a bit of letter writing and advocacy, and certainly boycotting the companies that NORPAC, who was the boycott target, were trying to boycott those products. And recently, the farm workers actually were able to get what they needed, and the boycott is called off. And it's one of those interesting things. Seems like a very small way that Holden has been involved in a food process, but it seems to have meant a tremendous amount to the farm workers and people who were involved in the NORPAC boycott, and it worked. It took 10 years. That's kind of something to keep your ears out for, is things that are happening that you can lend your support to, whatever it might be.
I work for the University of Minnesota. The legislature 3 years ago set up some regional partnerships where citizens decide what research priorities are in their region and ask the university to fulfill its land grant mission by serving the needs of the people. And the whole issue of local food systems has been, there are 5 partnerships around the state right now, and that's a real, there's a lot of interest in strengthening local food economies. And that's, what's been really frustrating is that is so counter to the trend. Well, I mean, that's why the partnerships were set up, right? So it's not like it's a surprise that it's frustrating, but the research dollars and the research programs have over the last, 8 or 9 decades, just lined up so completely with the corporate powers in agriculture that there's just not researchers even, there are so few researchers that are even interested in the sorts of problems or solving the kind of problems that we're asking them to do. That's just, at least there are partnerships, you know, I mean, I think there's sort of some hope that the legislature recognizes that the university needs to be more responsive. But I'm wondering is there movement in Washington with the university sort of meeting the needs of the small farmers?
We were able, I think, to meet some people who were pretty directly involved with that at this conference that we went to that was on food, faith, and sustainability, and some really neat people who were trying to get programs set up at Washington State that taught small organic farming methods that supported, local systems. And yeah, it's hard because the money is with the corporations.
Right, it's so small compared to...
But it seems like at least there is being some effort made, and there are small things that are happening, farmers markets, and you can now as a WIC recipient, go to a farmer's market and get at least produce. Mm-hmm. You know, those kinds of government changes are happening out here slowly.
The College of Agriculture at the University of Minnesota hosted a conference in April called Foods for Health, and it was all about super broccoli and super tomatoes and all GMOs that have specific traits spliced into them, right? And the nice thing is that during all of the conversations, that breaks, the conversation drifted completely to, well, what if we just ate more vegetables? what if we grew more vegetables? You know, I mean, what if we just sort of lay off the French fries, or, you know, this, some of it's so, it doesn't have to be as complicated as that.
I think that there's, I just wrote this little essay that had just a kind of an important point to me that I haven't really thought about a lot, but, you know, agriculture and the whole study of agriculture and the study of food is something that, as this country has in the past 100 years changed so utterly from being an agricultural economy to being nothing to do with agriculture. I mean, to have such a small percentage of people know anything about agriculture, you know, unless you grew up on a farm, you know, unless you had that experience. Certainly, I didn't know anything when I was growing up. And, you know, that it would be an important thing to teach in primary school to mm-hmm. kids. You know, gosh, what do you eat? Where does it come from? How is it grown? You know, who makes those decisions? You know, when you get to junior high, who makes the decisions about what you eat? You know, how would you make decisions about what you eat? You know, so that by the time you're a senior in high school, you've had years of thinking about this, and it's just so not a priority. And to me, it's just all of a sudden started to be like, oh my goodness, why isn't this a priority? You know, why don't people learn this stuff? Why don't, or, you know, even just the smallest bit of, you know, because we can no longer assume at all that anyone knows anything about the production and consumption of food, you know, other than going to the grocery store and buying what's on sale.
I know Jeff Berman was in the village earlier. Is it possible, like, to have the farmers come and, you know, talk with our group? I mean, if they are interested in doing it themselves, I don't know if they're.
Why, yes. In fact, we've Chrissy made a wonderful effort last fall and started what we hope will become an annual and actually biannual tradition of with a fall harvest festival, and invited some of the farmers up to kind of as a celebration of the harvest last fall, and some of those farmers got to meet each other, and we just kind of had fun and talked. And then throughout the year, in the spring, several farmers came up, and some of them did various sessions. Folks at Sunny Pine are really into some of aromatherapy and some of essential oils, and Ed Welch did a discussion on essential oils and kind of what that's been to him, and Troy Karpinko did a session on a kind of just his whole experience in sustainability, and Grant Gibbs from Leavenworth did a wonderful long session about his farm and just how it works and what all the things that he's done about it. And I think all of us who went to that learned a heck of a lot. But anyway, this fall we're planning our harvest festival as well,
and we hope to have, when we were out visiting these farms, we talked with the interns there, and the interns are really interested in Holden. They've never been up here, or some of them have, but a lot of them haven't, and they're really excited to come up here. So again, with all of the questions of building community, we hope to have a lot of those folks gathered here in the fall and have a chance to just kind of chat.
One of the things that we've been talking about how important it is to know your farmer and where you get food from, but the other side of that equation is how important it is for the farmer to know where the food goes. I think there's a few of the interns from Sunny Pines that came up in the spring, as well as some of the farmers, and got a chance to see the community and see where all of this stuff, all this stuff they're working on, all this back-breaking in the sun work, and where it's providing for, and who gets the food eventually. And I think that's a real uplifting thing for them as well. So it can't be, it's not just a one-sided equation with those guys.
One of the most powerful things of all of that for me, though, was that in the spring, we had a blessing of the seeds and a blessing of the farmers at our worship service. And that was probably the most powerful, as fun as the harvest of the world, to me. And to see these farmers feel really, truly blessed by us and connected to us in that way, and have in the seeds, and seeing lots of people touch these seeds that will then go back and become our lives.
One of the stories that we heard while we were out, the Holden High School went to visit Sunny Pine, and the seeds which we blessed here when Sunny Pine came up were then planted in the lettuce seeds by our high school students, and apparently without a whole lot of guidance, they came up with the whole idea that, wow, we're planting some of our own food, and we're really excited about this. And they, whatever conversation they had, clearly affected the farmers, because they remembered it and were telling us this as we visited. So there's some good things going on. I'm aware it's probably time to kind of wrap up.
Are you taking any more questions?
Jen, you have a burning question.
I was just wondering, what are your long-term goals for incorporating organic and local produce into the menu?
I have some long-term questions. I'm leaving. I don't know. I think certainly to continue with what we've done, I think looking pretty seriously at the question of knowing that we've probably gone as far as we can within the current budget, I think doing some research as to what we might need to do to go even further, and then to talk about that and figure out how that might affect the community and the guests coming here. I think ideally I would love to do as much as we possibly could to get food from local, if not organic, sources. And at this point, I think that would be the conversation that we need to have. So I'm excited to see the village at least bring that up as a topic of discussion.
I think for me, that's what's hugely important to me kind of in this next winter and the probably through the time that I'm here, is to bring up that discussion. You know, I don't, again, with the question of, I don't want food to be a kind of the whole topic of food to be connected with kind of personal angers about what's being taken away from people, because that's not helpful to anyone, really. And yet, I think that there's a lot of wonderful discussion to be had about, to just think about what we eat and where we buy from and what we want to do and what we want Holden to be, you know, looking at all of the families that come to Holden and where they come from and what's important for us, not only as a kind of a long-term winter community, but as, you know, the point of Holden in terms of being a retreat center that opens its doors to all of these people, especially during the summer months. How do we want to be both a place of comfort and renewing qualities and also a place that maybe challenges some people and offers new ideas to people and how to strike that balance. So I just hope that these conversations can continue.
Education is huge.
For myself, I think one of the things that would be nice to see is the winter community to become more sustainable, I guess is the best word, about what we use. It's in the summer, it's such a huge number, and luckily it's also the growing season, so it's a good time for it. In the winter, though, we really don't have any options for food unless we start thinking about canning pretty seriously, unless we start thinking more about meat and where we're getting it from, that kind of thing, and whether that's even possible with the amounts we're talking about as well. But it'd be nice to see that we don't... I mean, something as basic as not having bananas and oranges up here all winter long, something as basic as not eating nasty tomatoes all winter long, but having canned tomatoes instead. I mean, those are pretty fundamental shifts, and they're not going to be really easy ones that would happen, but they're definitely a good idea to think about for the least.
I think that hunting is a terrific idea.
Yeah,
we have work parties that come up and help us to start the village up with that.
Now we have a hunting party.
Welcome to the health department. Yeah. But I think
we've actually talked about whether it's possible we might be able to do this. We're getting around some of those health issues.
Getting around.
Because the winter community kitchen is different than summer.
It's not.
Thank you all for
Thank you.
No.